Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist from the 13th of October 2018. And I'm just reading through this to get skill and going through the very first chapter. So this is episode one. It's the editorial, and the editor is Emily Wilson, so she's presumably the author. There's a picture of a desiccated livestock and drought-stricken area, and the headline is "The Beginning of the End." It's byline: "We've missed many chances to limit warming. This may be our last." It was always likely to come to this, despite decades of ever starker warnings and years of increasingly obvious changes to the climate. We still haven't done nearly enough. Now, according to the latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, the UN's advisory body on the science of global warming, we're rapidly running out of time. Limiting warming to a manageable but still dangerous 1.5 degrees is possible, strictly speaking, but it would require, quote, rapid, far-reaching, and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society by 2030. See page 6. That would mean starting not sometime in the future, but right now. Will humanity do what's necessary? For individuals, that means making sacrifices and sticking to them forever. For politicians, that means an end to the indulgence of fossil fuel industry, investing in renewable energy and carbon capture and storage, radically transforming transport, halting deforestation, as dropping the remorseless pursuit of economic growth above everything else. Will all of this happen? Your response is probably not likely. If we don't act, though, the consequences are grave, and we are going to hit us within the lifetime of our grandchildren. As the IPCC says, even if everyone sticks to the Paris Agreement, we are currently on course to warm the planet by 3 degrees by the year 2100. Or 2100. That would mean a decisive end to the balmy and benign Holocene climate that had allowed our civilization to flourish. And the start of something much less hospitable, heat waves, flooding, wildfires, drought, famine, will come much more common in every inhabited continent, which is why most of us try not to think about it too much. If anything, denial is deepening. The populist revolt is hostile to climate action, and its leaders have managed to tar environmentalists as just another wing of the liberal elite. Populism thrives by offering simplistic solutions to complex problems, the exact opposite of what the world needs right now. Page 4. The natural reaction to the IPCC report was wider developments may thus be despair. But that guarantees only one outcome, defeat. As the report makes clear, we still have time to pull off a rescue. It will arguably be the largest project that humanity has ever undertaken, comparable to the two world wars, the Apollo program, the Cold War, the abolition of slavery, the Manhattan Project and building the railways, and the rollout of sanitation, electrification, all in one. In other words, it require us to strain every muscles of human ingenuity in a hope for a better future. If not ourselves, then at least for our descendants. Is it possible? Over the coming weeks and months, we will be reporting on ways which we might transform society into a avert crisis. The history of humanity is one of stupidity, denial, dawdling, followed by heroic rearguard action to avail against all odds. The climate crisis is close to that inflection point. Does our generation have the gumption? It's time to find out. What a beautiful thing. She's still really got the heroic writing. Sometimes I write like that, but when I reread it, I go, oh, gee, you're a moron. Okay. Again, we don't know who's this. This is thing. The prize for pricing climate change. Small thing. The 2018 Nobel Economics Prize has gone to William Nordhaus and Paul Romer for integrating climate change into technological innovation into a macroeconomic analysis. Nordhaus of Yale University created the first model describing interplay between economy and climate in the 1990s. His work is now used to study the consequences of climate policies and has been very influential in guiding thought about how the world should tackle climate change. with a key recommendation that governments, corporations and households should have to pay a price on carbon emissions. Rummer, at the New York University, is known for demonstrating how economic forces influence the willingness of firms to produce new ideas and innovations, and how the knowledge can drive economic growth. In 1990, while mainstream economists were expecting growth to taper off, Rummer overturns this idea by emphasizing humans' limited capacity for invention. It seems, you know, you would lump the two together, but they're actually not lumped. The Hubble in trouble. Now, there's a picture of the Hubble Space Telescope, and to me, it's just such a glorious picture. One of our most important windows to the universe, the Hubble Space Telescope, has been taken offline after two of its gyroscopes failed. Very stressful weekend, Hubble deputy mission scientist Rachel Alston wrote on Twitter. Quote, right now, HST is in safe mode while we figure out what to do. Hubble has six gyroscopes, which measure the rate of motion as it moves, ensuring this telescope stays pointing in the right direction. Three are needed for it to work most efficiently, but two had previously failed and two went down over the weekend, leaving only two now working. Hubble can still operate with one or two gyroscopes, but its view of the sky is restricted. The mission team has hoped that one of the gyroscopes might yet be brought back online. Quote, Hubble's instruments are still fully operational and are expected to produce excellent science for years to come, said NASA in a statement. Hubble has been observing the skies since 1990. All six gyroscopes were replaced when it was last serviced in 2009 by a crew of the astronauts flying on the space shuttle. The space shuttle retired in 2011, and it's not currently possible to send astronauts for another repair mission. In 2016, NASA announced that the telescope would continue operating to June 2021, by which time its successor, the James Webb Telescope, is due to be working. Although the project has been repeatedly put back. So there's going to be a dark ages here. Brazil may exit Paris climate deal. It's not a move in the right direction. It's the first round of Brazil's presidential election has been won by the far-right candidate who wants to withdraw from the Paris climate agreement. This comes just as a major climate report has highlighted how we aren't doing nearly enough to meet the targets of the deal. Jair Bolsonaro, Pichet, will face a left-wing Workers' Party candidate in the second round of the 8th of October. It's not a very flattering picture. After he failed to get 50% of the total votes, the requirement to win outright in the first round. As a large developing country and home of the Amazon rainforest, Brazil's actions really matter when it comes to further climate change. At one point, the country had succeeded in greatly slowing deforestation, but in recent years, the rate of loss has soared. The Amazon rainforest has been cut down to make way for cattle ranches, soya farms. High prices of soya, as well as reduced funding for forest protection, are behind the change. Google's social network is closing. Google is shutting down its social network, Google Plus, for non-business users following the disclosure of a flaw found in March. It exposed personal information after 500,000 people. News came on a blog post on Monday, which was Google's first public description of the privacy bug. Citing anonymous sources, the Wall Street Journal said Google deliberately avoided disclosing the problem at the time, in part to avoid drawing scrutiny. The flaw could have allowed 438 external apps to scoop up usernames, email addresses, occupations, gender, and age without authorization. The company says it found no evidence that any of the affected personal information was misused. It says that is one reason it delayed disclosing the problem. Google Plus was supposed to be a challenger to Facebook's social network, but it flopped and quickly turned into a digital ghost town, prompting Google to start de-emphasizing it several years ago. Okay. God. This is by Chelsea White. The first hive mind game of Tetris. Three connected brains solve a problem in a world first. I love the world first. They're really just, you know, it's a world first. Using only their thoughts to communicate, three people wearing brain reading caps work together to play Tetris. This is the first instance of more than two people collaborating through a brain-to-brain communication. So it's two people now, he's added a third. Quote, our experiment can be regarded as the first proof of concept demonstration that multiple human brains can consciously work together to solve a task that none of the brains could solve individually. Okay, that's an interesting proposition, because you've got two people watching, and why do you need two people watching to do it? That's a really disturbing statement. That's the concept. Oh, yes, it's not, because a normal human brain can solve Tetris. I think it has been done before. Using the BrainNet interface, three people can combine minds to play a slow version of Tetris. The first two send information about the state of the game to the third player, who decides which move to make. Two senders wear an EEG, an electroencephalography caps, to record the brain signals produced by the thoughts, while the receiver wears a transcranial magnetic stimulation cap that delivers information to the brain. Okay, so you can actually send magnetic pulses into the brain. The senders can see the entire play area, and so have to tell the receiver whether or not to rotate the tackle block. The receiver only sees the current block, not the state of play. Okay, so it's just a test block and other things. So they must rely on information from the senders. They communicate with the receiver by focusing on one of two flashing red lights that sit next to the word yes or no to decide the computer screen. This choice can be seen by the EEG data in the signals of the visual cortex. To pass the information on, the receiver's occipital lobe, the brain's visual processing center, is stimulated magnetically by the TMS cap, where the senders think yes, causing the receiver to see a flash of light. Gee, that's pretty interesting. The senders have 15 seconds to send the decision, and two decisions are received 8 seconds apart. Okay, so the two people think together. Okay. The real Tetris game would be too fast for the current version of BrainNet Surreal. The team also tested whether the receiver could judge if the guidance was accurate by asking one sender to give a correct solution. The receiver then had to learn which sender was more reliable, then deciding whether to rotate the block. After each move, the receiver was told whether they had made the right choice. Five groups of three people played Tetris as part of an experiment of rotating the block to fit the row below, an average accuracy of 81%, including trials where wrong instructions were sent. Rawls says that linking brains together to solve problems in this way may bring, oh my god, may bring significant advances. Quite extrapolating this idea, one could regard networks of connected brains as humanity's solution to overcoming the biological limits of brain evolution, he says. Oh god, that makes me sick. Okay, we are probably in the pre-hive mind phase, says Giulio Raffini at Neuroelectrics at Barcelona, Spain. I think that's the other whack group there. I think I saw it in a documentary. They keep on doing these whack ideas. The new network is an incremental improvement on the current technology, says, but it is a step forward for non-invasive brain-to-brain communication. His colleagues, Anna Marquis, says the most practical way to use this technology would be helping people who cannot speak, either because of their neurological or physical limitations. Quote, or you could use many brains to compute a difficult problem, or do something abstract like write a song. But I think that's wishful thinking, she says. So why record it here in this article for us to read? Anyone can wish anything. Attempts to merge brains with computers either through surgically implanted chips or non-invasive techniques like that developed by Rao and his colleagues are being undertaken by companies such as Facebook, Elon Musk, Neuralink, a variety of startups, and the US military research arms, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. I think they're just a funding one. I don't think they actually do that's research data. Don't go thinking you're going to intercept the idea of a palace mind anytime soon, though. Facebook and DARPA have both said their early goals are to allow people to interact with software programs or type without using their hands. A mind-meld video game may still be years away. Really. I think it's verging on the unethical. Okay, news and technology by Michael LaPlage. Can we limit warming to 1.5 degrees? This looks like a question and answer one. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, has released a report comparing the probable impacts of 1.5 degrees warming with 2 degrees and assessing what it would take to keep to this lower level. It synthesizes all published research up to the 15th of May this year. Here's what you need to know. Presumably, we are much better off limiting warming to 1.5 degrees. Right. But the... Oh. This is an interview form, but he's not interviewing anyone. He's just... He's actually producing it as if it was an interview. Right. But the consequences are still severe, especially for those countries under the most threat of rising seas. So can we limit the warming to 1.5 degrees C? No. The IPCC report says that it's not that categorical, but an early draft leaked in February came close. There's a very high likelihood that under the, quote, there's a very high likelihood that under the current emission trajectories, the current national pledges, the Earth will warm to more than 1.5 degrees above the pre-industrial levels. Yeah, I'm really troubled by this because he's not... It's like a interview, but you can't see who he's interviewed. He's sort of, it's sort of dramatic, but it's great journalist, but it's bad. This is watered down in a later leak. There is no simple answer to the question of whether it is feasible to limit the warming to 1.5 degrees, because feasibility has multiple dimensions. Even this got cut up from the final report. Weight watered down? While the first draft of the IPCC report written by climate scientists, the final wording is the outcome of political negotiations among diplomats. We know from the leaks that the US was one of the countries trying to water it down. Okay. Why? Who's saying this? I don't know. Why can't we limit the warming to 1.5 degrees? There are two aspects of this. First, if aliens landed tomorrow and took away all our fossil fuels, how much hotter would the planet still get? And if the aliens don't arrive, how much extra warming will we cause? According to the study out in August, too late to be included in the report, the world might pass 1.5 degrees even if those aliens arrive. To be clear, the study does not say this is definitely the case, just that it is not impossible. Okay, so this is really edgy journalism as far as I'm concerned. Game over then. Most of the site studies suggest that there's only one way to keep the warming below 1.5, or at least to get back down to a level later this century after overshooting it. This would not only require emissions to decline very rapidly, but would take radical and unprecedented changes in every aspect of our lives, including leaving oil and coal reserves in the ground. It would also mean having to actually remove CO2 from the atmosphere. So we can't just do that. Yet, he's quoting from someone. Even if it's technically possible without allying the technical, political, and social aspects of feasibility, it's not going to happen, says Glenn Peters of the Center for International Climate Research at Oslo. For now, global emissions are still increasing, and yet we have to find a plausible way to remove huge quantities of CO2 from the atmosphere. Quote, there's a high chance that the level of CO2 removal required might not be feasible, quote. He said the early draft. Okay, this is okay. Forget 1.5 degrees. How about 2 degrees? According to the report, if the countries make cuts they say they will, we're on course for 3 degrees, warming about 2100. That's depressing. It's not looking good, but even if the world doesn't meet either of the Paris targets, every reduction in emission will help limit warming. So, this is, I think, rather strange. I think it's just poor journalism. We don't know who he's asking the questions for, or has he done a medley? it's okay for doing a student doing it. It's just whether you can actually get the doing here. And there's a photograph where it looks as though they've got 1.5 degrees written in on the Paris, but it could be that, or you know, you have to know where this. Oh, so Tuckasset. There's a picture here of the Eiffel Tower, and it just seems that the writing 1.5 degrees is not. It just looks photoshopped to me. Okay, now this is by Lee Crane. Strong signs of first ever exomoon. The first moon to be spotted orbiting an exoplanet is slowly coming into view. The Hubble Space Telescope has found more evidence of an exomoon unlike any in the solar system. Okay, well, okay. In 2017, the New Scientist reported David Kipling and Alex Chichi of Columbia University and New York had spotted a possible exomoon in the data from the Kepler Space Telescope, orbiting a distant planet called Kepler 1625b, which is about 1,000 light years away. It was enough to inspire researchers to look more closely, but it was not the discovery itself. Quote, we've had candidates in the past and investigating them, and most of them have evaporated, Kipling said at the time. But this exomoon candidate has not evaporated. Evolution of the observation of the Hubble's, with the Hubble, showed two hints that might really be there. The first was the exoplanet passed in front of the star 78 minutes earlier than we would have expected if it had no moon, indicating that something is dragging it on gravitationally. The second was another, smaller dip in the star's starlight after the dip caused by the planet passing by, suggesting the two objects are crossing the star. The measurements indicate that a gas giant that indicates a gas giant about the size of Jupiter, orbited by a moon much bigger than any in our solar system. It's difficult to explain with a current view of how moons form in the solar system. Quote, it will appear two times bigger than the Earth's moon in the sky, says Chichi. What the heck? That really upsets me. Having a moon the size of Neptune with a Jupiter-sized planet sort of defies explanation. That's really, you've got my head confused. Like its planet, the moon is probably a gas giant with an average temperature of around 27 degrees Celsius. If it weren't made out of gas, that would mean that it would potentially be habitable. But Kipling cautions, it is too early to say, quote, you don't know very much about the condition of the moon at all. We don't even know sure that the moon is there. Amazing. Industry slowed before medieval crisis hit Europe. Now, this is actually quite an interesting article. Years before the Great Famine and the Black Death hit 14th century Europe, so that's 1300s, something like that, the continent was already in trouble. That's the conclusion of a massive new analysis of timber used to construct the historical European buildings, dated using tree ring method. Wood is routinely collected from archaeological sites and dated. Friedrich Charpentier of linguist, historian at the Stockholm University in Sweden, and his colleagues scoured early studies to compile data of nearly 50,000 pieces of wood used in the construction of buildings between 1700. All the wood came from Central and Western Europe. Compiling the data allowed researchers to establish the history of development over a 450-year period and compare it with the record of historical events. Quote, the felling dates are basically a new historical source of material for studying demographic and social economic history, says Charpentier, linguist. Tree rings date show a significant slowdown in building activity began around the year 1300. Okay, a few years. About 15 years later, a period known as the Late Medieval Crisis began. First came the Great Famine, followed by a few decades later by the Black Death. A plague, the outbreak from 1353, killed millions of people across Eurasia. Chapter Lindqvist and his colleagues said the slowdown in buildings from the year 1300 suggests society was in trouble, and the population was stagnating even before the medieval crisis began. He said bad harvests and other hardships probably initiated the problem. Researchers found slowdowns in building activities in other points of European history, particularly during the Thirty Years' War from 1618 to 1648. It's pretty interesting, the Thirty Years' War, the religious war. We subconsciously treat naysayers as leaders in the picture of Donald Trump. And this is an article by Alice Klein. That was by Joshua Rapp-Lerm, but this one is by Alice Klein. And there's a thing showing Donald Trump. Donald Trump's rise to power may be down to his critical approach. Okay, we subconsciously treat naysayers as leaders. Critical people often ascend to positions of leadership because their disregard of a social necessity makes them seem powerful. According to Arlene Chua of the University of Virginia, who explored people's attitude towards naysayers, those who express negative critical views, and cheerleaders, those who express positive supportive ideas. Across 11 experiments, she found that the naysayers were considered more powerful and suitable for leadership roles than cheerleaders. In one experiment, students were asked to repeat positive and negative restaurant reviews, to read negative and positive, or positive and negative. They rated the author of negative views as appearing more powerful, independent, and able to express their real opinion about the restaurant. Another experiment, students were placed in groups and asked to review an artwork. Each group contained two actors, one critical views and the other with appreciative views. The students rated the critical actor as appearing more dominant and in control, and were more likely to elect them as group leader. A third experiment, especially if they fear being criticized themselves and want to use that, you can't use positive energy, can you? The third experiment was asked online, was that the Amazon's something or other monkey, if not Survey Monkey, something like that. Oh, some machine where you just can put something online and put it up to 10 for people to do. A third experiment asked online volunteers to read real quotes from past US presidential candidates. Without knowing who said them, the participants rated negative quotes like, "These are very difficult times, challenges for America," a signaling greater power and leadership potential. Despite these endorsements, the participants rated naysayers as being less likable than cheerleaders. But this appeared to be offset by their respect for the naysayers' courage to go against the grain. The Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. Since negativity is generally considered impolite, openly critical individuals may seem to transcend social constraints and therefore be more powerful, says Chu. This may lead us to instinctively treat them as leaders, even if we don't like them. The findings may explain why negative bullying types are able to rise to positions of power and influence, says Chu. They may also be partially explained the success of Donald Trump, who disregards the convention and appears unafraid to openly critical, says Frank Mollers of the University of Queensland in Australia. Quote, "His ability to speak to the mind seems to appeal to voters who interpret his boldness as a sign of authenticity," he says. However, it would be simplistic to conclude that Trump is elected US president because the voters responded instinctively way to his negativity resulting in the appearance of his power. This is Moles. To suggest Trump supporters were driven by subconscious impulses would be to dismiss the fact that they have had different reasons, like concerns about migration, to vote for him, he says. Chell says it's important to note that findings are only relevant to the initial establishment of power. Once naysayers become leaders, their negativity may make them unpopular and lead to their fall, she says. We are conducting further research to examine this possibility, she says. Moreover, the results, that's rather interesting in terms of there's some stop-back gap here in this red stream, i.e. it's not, we're going to do it, I've done, and now I think I want to research this. Moreover, the results shouldn't be interpreted as meaning we are doomed to always have naysayers, the national leaders, says Stu. In countries where public discourse has turned negative, individuals who express positive optimistic ideas may be seen more powerful because of their opposing views, she says. This may explain Black Obama's success in being elected US president in 2008, with the message of hope and positivity, she says. So we all secretly like Barack and don't like Trump. But the interesting thing here is how this fits into to other analysis. So the fundamental analysis is if you're a negative say, if you pull people down, you will tend to rise up in a group. I just have to see if I can remember what the other US article was about Trump. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll get this off and get on to the next article soon.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.